This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. The dust has pretty much settled from Tuesday's elections in New Jersey. The entire assembly was up for grabs, and to the surprise of few, Democrats remain the majority party, and in fact will enjoy their biggest margin over the GOP since the late 1970s. For the first part of the hour, we'll talk about the election itself and, moving forward, how this might affect the gas tax, pensions, and gun control. Also, what do Tuesday's election results mean for Governor Christie as he continues his campaign for the Republican nomination for president? Joining us are Bridget Harrison, professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. Welcome, Bridget.
Thank you, Mary.
And Matt Friedman is reporter for Politico New Jersey and author of the New Jersey Playbook. Hello, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks.
So a big night for New Jersey Democrats on Tuesday. Matt, at last count, how many seats did the Democrats pick up?
We know they've picked up three, and there's a good chance they picked up four seats for a majority of 52 out of eight. So it was a really good night for them. Not a great night for democracy because it was the lowest turnout our state has ever seen. Good night for Assembly Democrats. Absolutely.
So not quite a veto-proof majority in the Assembly coming up in 2016?
That's right. They've got 52, and they would need a veto-proof majority would be 54 if you can get every Democrat on board with something. Sometimes that's a challenge because there's some Democrats from some pretty conservative-leaning districts that are a lot of times, frankly, given a pass to vote on their party. But this will make overrides starting in January a little bit easier in the Assembly. So the Democrats will only have to pick up, will only have to pick off two Republicans instead of six, assuming they won all four seats.
Bridget, was this election a referendum on Governor Christie's performance in recent years? Was it a product of redistricting and super PAC money, or are we looking at some combination of all three?
I would say, Mary, all three of those. I mean, I think the determining factor in 90% of the legislative elections is the redistricting structure. And we have a very strong partisan gerrymander where the incumbent's party, by and large, in nearly every district is protected. In races where there is a competitive structure where you have almost equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, those are primarily in the southern New Jersey districts, in the first and second down by Atlantic City and Cape May. But I think that we also saw this super PAC money, in particular money spread around by George Norcross's PAC, particularly in the districts that the Democrats managed to pick up. The first, they picked up an additional assembly seat. They maintained their seat in the assembly in the second. And in the 11th, in a relatively surprising win, Norcross had also put some money into that race. Of course, we also saw the influence of the New Jersey Education Association, which together between Norcross and the NJEA, about $8 million was pumped into, you know, these legislative districts in which we're electing part-time legislators making $49,000 a year. So it certainly was a victory for money and money's influence in politics. But there is no doubt that this, for many voters, whether they chose to vote or stay at home, it was a mandate on Governor Christie's leadership. The fact that this is the largest Democratic majority in decades speaks to that leadership. And I also think that along with what Matt was saying, you have now Republicans who were once rising stars in the party who now may be a little bit fearful for their own political careers. I'm thinking in particular of State Senator Jen Beck, who may be reluctant now to fall in step with Governor Christie because her political career is at stake. So that kind of undying loyalty, you know, that may have dissipated a bit with this election.
So Matt, let's look at the presidential campaign. How does this affect Christie, if at all?
Well, I don't think you're going to see voters even hearing about this in other states, but that doesn't mean it won't affect them. I just want to add a little to what Bridget was saying.
Sure.
In terms of this being a referendum on Christie. It wasn't a direct referendum on Christie, but it was certainly a show of what happened to the New Jersey Republican Party under his leadership. He sucked the oxygen out of the room. I mean, I'm not saying the Republican Party in New Jersey was in great shape when he got here, but he had this miraculous, he has an incredible political ability. And I think what you'll find when you talk to most people, when you talk to Republicans privately, frankly, is this governor has used his political stardom not to help build the party in New Jersey. It's an incredible fundraising ability, and yet the Republican Party in New Jersey is $500,000 in debt because of Bridgegate legal bills. And it spent $250,000 on private jet flights for the governor as he was leading up to his announcement for president. The Republican apparatus, such that it was when Christie got here, was put to building the Chris Christie brand. There is essentially no, there's regional Republican parties in New Jersey where they're strong, but the state party, it has floundered. And that, in that sense, this was a referendum on Christie's leadership. It was also, I think, aside from just the money that the public sector unions put in for this race, which was substantial, the $8 million figure was reported by ELEC. It's actually a little lower than that because some of the dollars, technical reasons, got double counted, but we still don't have the total, so who knows? Maybe we'll get up there. But the public sector unions got their revenge on a lot of the Republicans who have been Christie's, you know, top supporters. And the Assembly Republican leader, John Bramnick, was really the most loyal legislator to Chris Christie in a sea of loyal legislators.
Matt, you brought up Bridgegate briefly. I just wanted to get to that. If Christie thought the scandal might be fading from public consciousness, a recent mess with the Port Authority and former Christie appointee David Sampson and United Airlines at least temporarily brought the ghost back. How invested are voters? This is a winding narrative. How invested are voters in this narrative?
It's not so much that voters are following this point by point by point, but there will be trials. Let's say Christie actually does well, and it does extremely well. He wins in New Hampshire, and he does well enough in Super Tuesday in March to stay in the presidential race. That, at this point, appears to be a long shot. Let's say this. Then he's got Bridgegate trials happening in the last bout of primaries. You're going to probably have a lot of information coming out of these trials because of the defense and what the defense is entitled to get that we never heard, despite going over it incessantly. There could be a lot of damaging information. I'm not saying that the governor is going to be implicated directly, but I think it's hard to imagine that there won't be embarrassing things for his administration that come up in this trial when two former aides to Christie, his top appointee at the Port Authority and his deputy chief of staff, are throwing everything at the wall to defend themselves. So the ghost is still there. There's still an investigation into David Sampson, who, frankly, is one of the closest. Christie has always kept a very tight circle of real confidants, and he is, you know, one of the top three or four. There's a federal investigation into him and his conduct at the Port Authority and this flight that allegedly United Airlines made just for him.
So bottom line is this could dog Christie into next year if he continues with his presidential campaign.
Yeah, it's not over.
Well, what I'd like to do, I mean, he recently got a little bit of a shot in the arm in New Hampshire here, it seems. And he received a lot of attention recently for emotional remarks he made on the campaign trail in New Hampshire regarding addiction. His mother's longtime cigarette habit, a friend from law school who died addicted to prescription drugs and alcohol. Christie's pushing for better treatment for drug addicts, and he's tying this to his pro-life views. We have a brief clip. Let's take a listen.
We need to start treating people in this country, not jailing them. We need to give them the tools they need to recover, because every life is precious. Every life is an individual gift from God. And we have to stop judging and start giving them the tools they need to get better.
So, Bridget Harrison, what has Christie done in New Jersey to address this issue?
Well, he has done some kind of reforms. I'm thinking particularly of his efforts with regard to drug courts. He has worked in a relatively bipartisan manner with former Governor Jim McGreevy. Go ahead, Matt.
No,
I was going to jump in. But I think that the broader narrative here is that this enables Chris Christie in his campaign for the Republican nomination to remind pro-life voters that he is one of them. That is the backstory on this. Sure, this is comments about addiction. It's about how we need to change how we treat drug addicts, particularly drug addicts in the criminal justice system, but also kind of the undercurrent is reminding pro-life voters that he is pro-life. There was much made about his position on this. At some point, somebody accused him of flip-flopping, and he has made it enormously clear that he is pro-life. And that's really kind of a salvo out to those pro-life conservative voters in New Hampshire and particularly in South Carolina.
So, Matt, looking go ahead.
This has actually gotten a lot of attention, especially in the media. It's become a Facebook thing. I think this video had 5 million views this morning. Hmm. To us in New Jersey, it didn't immediately stick out. The Huffington Post packaged these comments and said, wow, look at this. They put it on Facebook and it went everywhere. Here in New Jersey, we've heard that speech. And we know that the governor is a great storyteller and a great talker. And so to us, it's like, oh, okay, this is another one of Christie going viral. This happens to us occasionally when we forget how talented this guy is, you know, compared to others out there. And sometimes it strikes the national media as fresh and new. I think if you talk to anti-drug advocates, they'd say his record on this topic is actually very mixed. You know, yes, he expanded drug courts, but they feel he didn't fund it enough. There was a Good Samaritan law earlier, I think 2012, where, you know, if two people are, you know, if you're using drugs with someone overdoses, you call the ambulance, you're immune from prosecution. Or even if you sold them drugs. And Christie vetoed that at first to the chagrin of drug treatment advocates. Only later, I think 6 months later, came around to it and did sign it. And a lot of people are very critical of him, you know, really treating marijuana, you know, as a criminal offense. And
he is against the decriminalization of marijuana.
Yeah, he's absolutely against it. And a lot of these advocates out there think that's a bad play. But the fact is, you know, this isn't really a partisan issue. This criminal justice reform and drug, court stuff. This cuts across all spectrums. But from what I'm seeing about how this video is spreading, I don't know if this helps him so much with primary voters. It's kind of spreading with everyone. But certainly it's a reminder of just what a talented politician we have here in New Jersey and why people are hesitant to count him out, even when his poll numbers are so low.
So we've got about 30 seconds before we have to get to the break. Looking ahead to the November 10th debate in Milwaukee, my understanding is he's going to have to average 2.5% support in some national polls to get to the main stage. He's been averaging 2%. If I had to ask you to hazard a guess, Bridget Harrison, do you think he'll get there?
Typically, what we'll see is that he pull some stunt to try to make him get into that group. Right now, it is looking very, very dicey. But like Matt said, I wouldn't count him out right now.
Okay, we're talking Jersey politics this hour of Ballot Talks. Governor Christie and his bid for the White House. Also, gun control, the gas tax, pensions. We're going to try to get to all of that and so much more. Our guests include Bridget Harrison, political science professor at Montclair State University, and Matt Friedman of Politico. And as always, we welcome you to the conversation. Our number is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. There's more of Radio Times coming up. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times. We are talking with Matt Friedman, reporter for Politico New Jersey. He's the author of the New Jersey Playbook. And also, Bridget Harrison is professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. And as always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'd like to get back just for a moment to Governor Christie on the campaign trail. There's a school of thought that perhaps at this point it's not so much the Oval Office he's aiming for, but perhaps Attorney General. Bridget Harrison, what do you think?
Well, I think that he started out certainly with his eyes on the presidency. I think that the position of vice presidency, most people have rejected that notion as they did in 2012. Chris Christie is simply not vice presidential material. He's not one to to share the spotlight, and indeed some of his political background may be considered baggage for many of the presidential candidates out there. The position of Attorney General is a really interesting one, particularly in light of the repeated scandals that we've seen throughout the state of New Jersey involving the Christie administration. Several years ago, that seemed like a likely prospect, right? Someone who had served as a U.S. attorney, done so in a relatively distinguished fashion, would be considered one of the contenders in that eligibility pool. What I think that we see now, though, is that the prospect of a Senate confirmation that would bring up all of the various scandals that have evolved in the Christie administration in the past 2 years, I'm not convinced that a presidential candidate would be willing to trade whatever support that Christie brings to the table in order to go through, you know, this would be a relatively new president, to go through that Senate confirmation hearing and hear some of those embarrassing details, perhaps occurring during these hearings, you know, the trials regarding Bridgegate. So I think it may be a bit of a stretch. But, you know, post his gubernatorial administration, I think it would be likely that we might see him as a host on Fox News or that kind of, you know, professional career beyond being governor.
Matt Freeman? Sorry, Bridget. Finish your thought.
That's fine. No, that's good.
Matt, your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are what Bridget said, essentially. I agree that, and I think that the scandals aren't over. What we've learned isn't over. Implicated, you know, not... It'll never be directly implicated, I'm sure, but there's enough of a whiff of scandal to really make it a confirmation seem almost impossible. I just think New Jersey politics can really be like quicksand. This is a very transactional state. We're known for our political corruption, and it's very hard to get out of here unscathed by it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what happens, but I don't really see that in the cards. It's going to be a real challenge.
Mary, if I could just add, typically these cabinet appointments are made because the appointee brings something to the table. At this point, it's really unclear what Chris Christie could bring to the table for his party's nominees. He can't carry the state of New Jersey for a Republican presidential candidate. His ability to raise money, yeah, sure, he did very well as chair of the RNC, but nowadays most of his presidential funds are coming from New Jersey voters. So, you know, I don't know that in terms of, you know, what he brings to a candidate that he would be worth making, you know, this is one of the big four appointments. I don't know that he would be worthy of a big four appointment in a Republican administration.
Okay, fair enough. Let's tackle gun control. So Governor Christie vetoed legislation which would make it more difficult for individuals in New Jersey who at one point had been committed to a psychiatric institution to have that history officially erased so they could buy firearms. The state Senate, including three Republicans, recently successfully voted to override. Matt, was this a surprise?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I knew that if there was a chance of something being overridden, this bill was the best one to date. But it was a surprise until the last minute. There's been, I think, 52 tries before this to override the governor, and Republicans have refused even on bills they overwhelmingly voted for, even on bills they sponsored. And this was, you know, there wasn't a huge reason to believe this time would be any different.
Hmm.
What's interesting is that, of course, there's a huge political game here on both sides, but this bill did not start politically. You know, Christie is saying, don't try to override me, don't play politics. This bill was suggested to the legislature, was requested by the administrative office to the courts. It was a very minor thing. It had Republicans and Democrats as sponsors. It was not controversial, didn't have a single vote against it when it passed the Senate and Assembly. But the governor, who was once actually... pro-gun control in a lot of ways, won't sign a single piece of legislation at this point that would increase gun control in any sense. So he vetoed it. I think it just became after asking Republicans to reverse their votes again and again and again, and with his political star declining, and with him spending more and more time out of state, and with him, as we saw in this last election, devoting not really many resources to helping legislative Republicans, I think it was just one too many, and it happened. So now we have to see if the Assembly overrides it. The Assembly, which just lost four Republicans, I mean, they'll still be there for the override vote.
Sure.
But let's see how they feel about it, because this was an election where the governor, frankly, was a liability more than anything.
We're going to get back to the Assembly in just a moment. But Bridget Harrison, I'm just wondering if the recent tragedy of the mass shooting in Oregon, it wasn't a tipping point of some point here.
Well, I don't know that it was. I think if when you watched the debate on the veto override in the state Senate, several legislators took and made points. Well, you know, we were told bad information, for example, that the shooter in Columbine or the shooter in Sandy Hook would have not committed those crimes. And essentially, these were really false arguments. All of the legislators, as Matt said, voted for this measure. Many of them even voted, or several of them, several Republicans voted to override, and then switched back to not override. You know, what we actually saw was people who had sponsored this legislation voted to not to override, which is, you know, really, in my view, kind of really compromising one's political values. But this was not, I think, for the Republicans who were supporting the governor, this was not about the issue itself. It was rather about that they, you know, many of them were strong-armed or recognized the writing on the wall. You have a governor campaigning in South Carolina saying gun control laws have not changed since I've been in office. He wanted to continue to have that bragging right. Now, of course, he does not.
And he hasn't suffered an override yet either.
Well, that is up to the assembly, but it is on its way.
Well, that was my next question. The assembly might be a tougher sell. I mean, Republican leader John Bramnick is now saying he wants give back on other issues like estate taxes or pensions before he goes along with an override. Now, granted, Matt, you just need a few Republicans, right, in the assembly.
It's a taller order in this case because there's a Democratic vacancy right now. It will be filled in January, but the Democrats actually need to pick off seven Republicans in this case because one of their seats is vacant. But it's absolutely possible. And I'd just like to note that John Bramnick himself, who's going to have to lead the charge against the silver ride, is a prime sponsor of this bill.
Absolutely.
You need a scorecard.
But what that means is that you can see the extent to which the Christie administration has co-opted the will of many legislators. This is really common sense legislation. It allows law enforcement to have a voice as to whether people who have been institutionalized are eligible to receive permits to purchase guns. Very common sense. Even the NRA is not fighting on this piece of legislation. And so I think, you know, when we look at John Bramnick's comments, I will remind you, Mary, that they were made before Tuesday's election.
Okay.
And so now, you know, Bramnick was kind of left holding the Christie baggage on Tuesday. And I'm betting my bottom dollar that he's getting a little bit of flack from people within his own political party about how Governor Christie's political career has really jeopardized some of the careers of Republican legislators who've been in office for many, many years. I think that there's a great deal of dissatisfaction on that. I don't know that the assembly will override in this lame duck session, but I think it is likely that the bill will be reintroduced. And then if the governor overrides it in the new legislative session, I would bet that veto would be overridden.
The state's transportation trust fund runs out of money next year. I think it's July, right? Many of New Jersey's roads and bridges are in dire need of repair. Raising a relatively low gas tax, which hasn't changed in 25 years, seems to many the obvious answer, but of course it's not that simple. Some lawmakers want to tie this to a cut in inheritance taxes or estate taxes. So the question is, where do you see this conflict going? And part two is, can the state afford any tax cut right now, Matt Friedman?
It has to be a compromise, and it has to be a compromise in which Christie can save face and claim to have raised one tax but cut others by the same amount. But the thing is, budgetarily in our state, our budget isn't in the greatest shape. to anyone paying attention over the last, I don't know, 10 years or more. And the fact is that if it's going to be quote unquote revenue neutral, the revenue hit will have to take place later because we can't frankly take it right now. So there's going to need to be an increase in the gas tax, or maybe they'll do it where they increase the gas tax, like they'll increase the petroleum receipt tax, which is, you know, a distinction without a real difference, because it will still increase the price of gas. But there's no way the governor can politically sign this bill by July and continue to run for president because he signed an anti-tax pledge. But at the same time, there has to be something done. And there, I can't imagine that there won't be, because this transportation trust fund is absolutely necessary. It needs to be funded. And the only thing worse than Christie's presidential ambitions than raising a tax is a huge transportation boondoggle in his home state that's embarrassing, or that even threatens people's lives.
Bridget Harrison, is the transportation trust fund being used for transportation or to pay down debt? I want to clarify that.
It is being used, in my view, for both. I mean, typically, the largest part of transportation trust fund money is being used to pay debt service. But what we also see is that this is the revenue source that provides the dollars that maintain New Jersey's bridges, roads, infrastructure. And without, I mean, an increase in the gas tax or some other funding source, the transportation trust fund will be bankrupt. What we see in New Jersey is that, you know, you can drive down the turnpike, and of course, when you leave New York or Pennsylvania, you notice all of the out-of-state cars buying gas in New Jersey. That
sure
makes perfect sense. There are different ways to structure a gas tax increase that could be neutral for New Jerseyans, but not enable out-of-state residents to derive the benefits from low taxes. This is particularly important for, you know, the trucking and transportation industry. I agree wholeheartedly with Matt. I don't think that the governor signs an increase in the gas tax while he is running for president. There are so many different issues in which New Jersey's best interests are kind of being put in a holding pattern until at least New Hampshire, or until the governor is either convinced to drop out or is in fact successful.
I would like to address the state's pension system. At the last I saw, it was $80 billion in debt. Christie administration proposal to overhaul government pension and health benefits put out in February. Where is that, Matt Friedman?
Well, it didn't help that the public sector unions really drove this election. I mean, this in such a low turnout election, this is where the unions can make a huge difference. Every public union member comes out to vote. Their friends and family come out to vote. I think that was a big factor here, aside from the millions of dollars they put into this money. So they put into this election. So now we have a strengthened Democratic legislature thanks to public sector unions. We also have a Senate president who is basically running for governor right now. It's hard to see how you come to real pension reform at this point. You have a president, you have a governor who's moved way over to the right to run for president, and you have a Senate president who used to be, you know, a fairly conservative Democrat running way over to the left to run for governor because he's got to win the Democratic nomination. There will be no substantial changes in pension during the next 2 years, or at least, well, I shouldn't make such absolute pronouncements, but it's very hard to say that. However, there's going to be a day of reckoning. There has to be. Because you look at these numbers and something has to be done. It just can't continue.
So, Bridget Harrison, if I'm a pensioner, how concerned am I that my retirement savings will be there when I want them?
Oh, if you're a public employee in New Jersey, particularly if you are already retired, sure. That is a great cause for concern. And I think also Senate President Steve Sweeney, in addition to moving to the left, we all recognize that taking a stand on reforming New Jersey's pensions cost Sweeney politically a great deal. He got a lot of flack from many of the public employee unions who had supported him. Some of that even became residual anti-labor sentiment directed at him. Sweeney is not going to pick up this issue again before 2017. And something does have to be done. You know, this is a really looming crisis. But unfortunately, the political careers of you know, both the legislative leadership and the governor are taking precedent over these really important problems facing New Jersey, including transportation trust fund and including the pension structure.
And one final...
I just want to say that that the Christie administration, you know, there was a pension solution passed over overwhelming objections of the public sector unions back in 2011. And but the thing is that the amount of money that the state would pay into the pension was based on really rosy revenue forecasts for the state that no one really believed, and that obviously didn't come true. So, you know, one component of this idea that the state has to fund the billions and billions of dollars in pension obligations. It said it would as part of the deal to get this pension change through. It doesn't look like our economy is going to improve to the point where that's going to be able to happen. So when the Democrats say fully fund the pension system, it's like, okay, how? We're talking billions of dollars here. What are you going to cut to do it? It's just not realistic.
So I know this is a state issue, but just quickly, we've got about 30 seconds or so left. How does the pension mess and the inability to keep promises play out in the national stage for Governor Christie? Bridget Harrison?
Well, I think that Governor Christie boasted of his success as a bipartisan leader. And the failure of his pension reform package, the hallmark of his administration, is demonstrative of the failure of his administration in general and really negates his claims at being able to successfully be a bipartisan leader.
Okay, that about wraps up our New Jersey portion of today's Ballot Talks. Bridget Harrison, political science professor at Montclair State University. We appreciate your input. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mary. Thank you.
And to you, Matt Friedman, reporter for Politico New Jersey and author of the New Jersey Playbook. We appreciate your joining us as well.
Thank you, Mary.
After the break, we look at the first state. Delaware is gearing up for some big elections next year. We'll be talking about that and gun control with Jonathan Starkey of the News Journal. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Stay with us here on Radio Times. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And for the remainder of the hour, we'll be looking at Delaware, which did not hold a general election this past Tuesday, but there are some big races shaping up for 2016. And also an issue making headlines regards the perceived right to bring guns to public meetings. We're going to go into that momentarily, but first let me introduce our guest, Jonathan Starkey of the News Journal. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey, Mary, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm well, thank you. So let's just touch on the gun issue first. Delaware does allow open carrying of firearms, but a relatively recent statute gives local governments the right to move to ban the carrying of firearms into public buildings and, by extension, public meetings. So we're talking about the prohibition of both open and concealed carry at public forums here?
Yeah, we're talking about bans on open carry in public buildings, and so the General Assembly last year, and I think like lots of other places, it's been difficult to get major gun control measures, even in a state dominated by Democrats. It's been tough to do that in Delaware. So the Democrats in Dover gave municipalities the right to ban open carry in public buildings, and there's been about a half a dozen municipalities that have taken them up on that: Lewis, Newport, Delaware City. So municipalities in all three counties, but as you might expect, that's caused some uproar for gun rights advocates who are kind of taking this fight to cities and towns, and which is interesting. It's come out of the state house and gone to the local level.
So this is being framed, it seems, as a First Amendment versus Second Amendment rights argument, correct?
I think that for Second Amendment advocates, I mean, I think that it's a pretty straightforward. I think it's a pretty straightforward issue. They say that any restriction on our right to carry weapons openly should be opposed. And I think that the big headline here is that it's just a fight that had been going on in the state house, that it's difficult to get things done in the state house just like it is in Congress, so it's gone to the local level. But I think for Second Amendment advocates, I think it's still a pretty straightforward, look, we have a right to carry carry weapons, and any restriction is something we're gonna oppose.
And for those who are pointing to the First Amendment, they're saying, you know, public meetings can become pretty passionate.
Right.
You know, if you see your neighbor's got a gun and you can see the gun,
right,
it might be cause for verbal restraint. So,
oh, exactly. Right, right. Well, I mean, I don't think people want to be uncomfortable in a public meeting if they've come to oppose a measure and see, you know, and you know, see somebody carrying a weapon. I think it generally just makes people feel, you know, on that side of the argument, uncomfortable. So, so we'll see what happens. I mean, I think it, you know, allowing some local action makes it more likely that restrictions be passed in certain areas like they already have been. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out statewide.
Well, Jonathan, you mentioned that just a handful of municipalities and county governments have actually moved to ban the carrying of firearms into public buildings. So it doesn't seem, where is public opinion on this? Were you able to get a sense of that? It doesn't seem
sure.
as if there's any great wave of municipalities moving to do this.
I don't. Well, you know, some of the bigger municipalities are looking at it now. I mean, I think there's a measure pending in Dover and Delaware's capital city, and in Newark, which is you know, which is a big Delaware municipality. So I think that some of the bigger cities, it's going to be a bigger debate because it's on a bigger stage. But I think the public opinion is pretty split. I think that you're right that it's not there's no overwhelming movement to restrict gun rights in Delaware, despite the fact that it's, you know, despite the fact that it's this blue state. I think the greatest evidence of that is that it's not happening at the state level, that it has to happen at the local level, and in more progressive cities are likely to, you know, likely to go forward first, and so we'll see where it goes.
Okay, well, 2016, back to politics. 2016
right.
is shaping up to be a big year for Delaware. Let's start with Wilmington. There will be an election for a new mayor or perhaps a re-election of the current mayor in Wilmington. The primary is next September, but already right. there's a packed field, Jonathan. There are six who are seeking the Democratic nomination.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not exactly a, you know, an endorsement of the mayor's performance. I mean, he's a former state lawmaker, a former police officer who came into office saying we're going to crack down on violence. Wilmington's Delaware's largest city. We have not seen a reduction in, you know, in what everybody watches, which are, you know, gun violence and homicides in the city. And people are just concerned about what's happening. And I think that's manifested itself in this big primary slate. So the council president is running. A couple former Wilmington councilmen are running. Eugene Young, who is a Delaware Center for Justice, a former aide to Cory Booker, mm-hmm. Is running. He's 32-year-old, so he's kind of galvanizing some support among younger Democrats.
And I might want to jump in here just for a moment. Yeah. I saw a picture of him. He's young. He's handsome. You know, he's kind of he looks like he could be an attractive candidate. He seems to be energetic. Just reading a bit of his bio, he seems to be he could be an attractive candidate.
Yeah, and he's already out. I was talking to him a couple of weeks ago. He's already out knocking on doors. I mean, we're mm-hmm. you know, we're still, like you mentioned, 10 months from a primary, and he is energetic. He's young. He's got a lot of young Democrats in the city and outside the city excited. I mean, I think people are looking for political change in the city, which is going to make it difficult for current mayor Dennis T. Williams to hold on to his spot. But obviously, he got elected in 2012. He's got his own support. State lawmaker. He was chair of the budget committee in Dover. So so I don't think we should count him out quite yet. But Wilmington's facing a lot of challenges in terms of violence and the economy and holding on to businesses that have been at the core of the city for a long time. So
is education a big issue in Wilmington as well?
Education is a big issue in Wilmington. You know, public education. The four school districts serve the city, so there's a great concern, plus charters. So there's a great concern that there's no single vision for educating city's children. So there's a redistricting effort going on right now to get more of those kids under the same banner and try to improve public education. That's a big issue statewide. There was an opt-out bill. This is going on all over the country that allow parents to opt their children out of standardized testing, passed the General Assembly. It was vetoed by the governor. So I think that lawmakers in Dover might take an override vote in January. So education is a huge issue statewide, but definitely in Birmingham, it's it's a big leading issue.
And I just wanted to focus on one more Democratic candidate, State mm-hmm. Senator Robert Marshall. He apparently wants to create an appointed police commissioner's position to be filled by a civilian from outside the city. Marshall's looking for a culture change within the police department. What is your sense? Would this fly in Wilmington?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that he's trying to stand out among the field, and he's frustrated like a lot of other people are with violence in the city. And I think it's something that can distinguish his campaign among, you know, a huge slate like you mentioned before. So it's unclear whether you know, that kind of change will be welcomed. I think the question for Senator Marshall, he served in the General Assembly since the late 70s. My question about his campaign is, can he get enough support? Can he drive enough energy around his campaign to be competitive and have his voice heard? And I think that his call for kind of restructuring the police department is a way to do just that, to stand out early in this campaign among big slate.
And Jonathan, anyone from the Republican Party show interest yet?
No, I mean, as you probably know, Wilmington is a blue city and a blue state, and the, you know, the winner of the Democratic primary is considered to be the odds-on favorite, more than the odds-on favorite, to be the mayor. So I don't think that we have any formally filed candidates on the Republican side. We'll have to see what happens there if Republicans are able to recruit somebody to offer a different vision.
Okay. Well, the 2016 campaign for governor is shaping up. Democratic Congressman John Carney enjoying a lot of support from party heavyweights. Tell us a bit about Carney, who was actually, he was beaten by current Governor Jack Markell in the Democratic primary in 2008. So for the uninitiated, who is he?
So he is a longtime, well-respected Democrat. He worked for Tom Carper, who's the senior U.S. Senator from Delaware, was governor in the 90s. Carney came out of that office. He was the Secretary of Finance, his Deputy Chief of Staff to Tom Carper. He served 8 years after that in the Lieutenant Governor's office. He was elected to 2 terms, and he's in his 3rd term in Washington in Congress. Like you say, he ran for governor as the favorite in 2008, but Governor Jack Markell raised a bunch of money, he had served 10 years in the Treasurer's office and was able to build a lot of support and upset him in 2008. But now Markell, the governor, is behind Carney's campaign. He's got the support of the Attorney General, Matt Dehn, who's considered at one time to have his eye on the governor's race, and also the rest of the federal delegation. So Carney has a ton of support here, which it's kind of cleared the field. There don't seem to be any other Democratic primary challengers. And we have a couple names on the Republican side, a state senator since 94, Colin Bonini, who'll have his hands full just for structural reasons. There's 125,000 more Democrats statewide registered than Republicans. So it's a tough road for any Republican, especially against a Democrat with such entrenched support.
So let's get to the Delaware has one seat in the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. and John Carney is leaving it to run for governor. So now there are, I believe, is a field of 5 Democratic candidates right now. Any standouts?
I think that Lisa Blunt Rochester, who just ended the campaign last week, she is from the city of Wilmington. Delaware's never elected a woman to serve in its federal delegation. I think her campaign has excited a lot of people around here. She's former state labor secretary and personnel director, and she is going to be running against a pair of state lawmakers, Brian Stewart and Brian Townsend, who are serving in Durbar currently. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say you can't necessarily count them out.
No, I don't think you can count them out because they're making names for themselves in Durbar. Although I think outside their district, it's unclear, you know, the kind of name identification either one has or how familiar people are with their records. I think Townsend, was trying to position himself as a progressive candidate, a more progressive candidate. And Brian Stewart, you have more of a centrist Democrat who's chair of the Economic Development Committee, is a well-respected small businessman. But I think that Lisa Rochester has kind of turned that race on its head by getting into it last week. And we might have another candidate who ran for treasurer last time, a guy named Sean Barney. He's a Iraq War veteran and might be able to build some support out of his out of that history. There's a group out of D.C. that is pledging to support him if he gets in the race. So I think that's our most interesting race next year.
Okay. There are a couple candidates from the Republican side.
Yep. And so a former city mayor from Dover, city of Wyoming, Hans Riegel, who is running on the Republican side, and a conservative activist named Rose Izzo, who has run a couple times before. She ran against Carney. And it looks like she'll also be running. I think she has a committee, or she updated her committee as filed with the FEC. So we'll have a general election to speak of after we get done with the primary next September.
So on the national stage, presidential contender Bernie Sanders met with Vice President Joe Biden late last week. He didn't seek Biden's endorsement. I think they were chatting about the need to address campaign finance reform and free college tuition. This is what I've been reading from Sanders' presidential campaign. But are you surprised he didn't seek Biden's endorsement?
No, I've been wondering what's going to happen with that. I mean, I think that it seems like they probably have similar views on campaign finance, some of those other issues. I'm not totally surprised. Obviously, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton served together in the Obama administration, and we're really interested in what Joe Biden's going to do because he's from here and was the U.S. senator from Delaware for 36 years. And I guess if you seek it and don't get it, that's worse news than if you just don't seek it and have a conversation. So for us, you know, I'm really curious what, I mean, I think everybody kind of had exhale moment after the vice president got out of the race whenever that was a couple weeks ago. People were watching really closely. He has really close friends and longtime political supporters here. So as far as people here, I think they're curious what he's going to do next. You know, what's he do after he leaves Washington, kind of forced retirement in January?
So now that Biden is not running for president, a number of Delaware's top political officials endorsed Hillary Clinton. Who's on board so far?
Governor Jack Markell moved pretty quickly to endorse Hillary Clinton. He's had some pretty straightforward concerns about the progressive movement and inside of his own party and how to approach economic issues. So he's firmly behind Hillary Clinton. John Carney as well, who's who we talked about, who's the front runner in the governor campaign. Tom Carper supporting Hillary Clinton to the U.S. senator. The only big statewide official that we haven't heard from is Chris Coons, U.S. Senator Chris Coons, who occupies that the vice president's old seat in the Senate, who I don't think has chosen yet. So we're still waiting for some word from him. Also, Dennis P. Williams, the mayor of Wilmington, is backing Clinton. So she's got pretty firm support in Delaware.
My understanding was Senator Coons had intended to back Biden had he run. Are you surprised that it's taking him this long to indicate a preference for any of the candidates?
You know, I think I was more surprised by the people who it didn't take very long. You know, they were, cause I think everybody was in that same position. They were all kind of waiting to see what Biden was going to do. I don't think anybody was going to jump from the Biden camp if he had gotten into the race. But yeah, I guess I thought we would have had something from Senator Coons by now. And I think we'll see him in Delaware tomorrow. So maybe I'll bug him a little bit about that and see where he is.
Well, Jonathan Starkey, stay tuned, right?
Right, exactly.
It should be an interesting year. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us
on
Radio Times. Jonathan Starkey is with the News Journal, and he reports on the first state, the state of Delaware. And this reminder, you can find our Facebook page and podcasts at whyy.org/Radio Times. We invite you to check them out. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane today. Hour 2 is coming right up, so stay right here.